AM and 90.9 FM HD3, Urbana.
Perelman, talking about his new book, The Invisible Handcuffs of Capitalism, How Market Tyranny Stifles the Economy by Stunting Workers, and also just talking about political economy in general. Should be a terrific show. I hope you join us for the full hour. But before we go to our guest, let's go to NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The polls are now closed in Greece in parliamentary elections, which could determine if that country remains part of the Eurozone. Initial exit polls suggest the two main contenders are almost neck and neck, that the center-right New Democracy Party leads the left-wing party by just half of 1%. The BBC's Gavin Hewitt reports from Athens.
The full weight of the European Union and Europe's leaders was deployed in persuading the Greek people that this was a choice between staying in the euro or leaving. However, it turns out, a very large number of Greek people have defied this pressure. They have voted in significant numbers for Syriza, a party that promised to tear up the bailout agreement, repeal some austerity measures, whilst insisting they wanted to stay in the euro. If these early results are confirmed, Greece could be in for a period of political instability. If New Democracy, the party which supports the bailout deal, edges ahead, these exit polls suggest it just might be able to form a government.
The BBC's Gavin Hewitt reporting from Athens. The polls have just closed in France, where voters are electing a new parliament. The Socialist Party of President François Hollande dominated the first round of voting last week. Is expected to win the most seats in the National Assembly today. That would end control by the Conservatives, aligned with former President Nicolas Sarkozy, who have held the chamber for a decade. Bombs exploded at three churches in northern Nigeria today. Officials say at least 19 people were killed, dozens were wounded. Violence against churches in Nigeria has been increasing in recent months. The Islamist group Boko Haram frequently claims responsibility for such attacks. It wants to impose strict Islamic law in Nigeria. Republicans in Iowa are sending a pro-Ron Paul slate of delegates to the GOP National Convention. Iowa Public Radio's Sarah McCammon reports, at the state convention this week, the party chose a clear majority of delegates with ties to the Texas congressman.
Iowa Republicans already suffered some embarrassment this year. They initially declared former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney the winner of the first-in-the-nation caucuses, but then after a recount, it turned out former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum had won. Now it's Ron Paul getting the love from Iowa. Republican blogger Craig Robinson was a state convention delegate.
I think it hurts the prospects of Iowa remaining first more than anything, because now we've had three different winners. And it's not that Ron Paul got the majority of delegates by like one vote. He has 23 of the state's 28 delegates.
Paul supporters point out they haven't broken any rules, and they say they've simply worked harder to advance their ideas. They acknowledge Paul does not have enough delegates to win the nomination. For NPR News, I'm Sarah McCammon in Des Moines.
This is NPR News from Washington. Rodney King, the black motorist whose videotaped beating by Los Angeles police sparked riots in 1992, has died at the age of 47. Police say they were called to his home in Rialto, California, early today and found King at the bottom of his swimming pool. Medics were unable to resuscitate him. An autopsy will be conducted. The police say a preliminary investigation shows no sign of foul play. A march gets underway in New York in about an hour, protesting that police department's stop-and-frisk policies. For member station WNYC, Ilya Meritz reports advocates want stricter controls on when police can search citizens.
600,000 people were stopped on the streets last year by New York City police officers looking for illegal weapons. Protesters believe the searches aren't random, but instead target young Black and Latino men. They're pushing legislation that would require officers to give out their business card if the person stopped isn't arrested. They also want an independent inspector general to look into allegations of misconduct. Only a small number of stops ever result in a weapon being confiscated. Mayor Michael Bloomberg has defended the practice as a big reason crime rates have stayed low. Today's march will be silent, modeled on one that protested mob violence against Black Americans in 1917. For NPR News, I'm Ilya Meritz in New York.
New York police shut down a nightclub in Soho last night. WIP is where a brawl erupted involving singer Chris Brown and rapper Drake's entourage. Punches and bottles were thrown. Several people were injured, including Brown and basketball player Tony Parker. The New York Police Department said the club was closed for code violations. It did not provide details. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Carnegie Corporation of New York, recognizing literature through the Andrew Carnegie Medals for Excellence in Fiction and Nonfiction at carnegie.org.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 with Media Matters. Our guest is someone who's been on the show before. I'm delighted to have back. Michael Perelman is a professor of economics at California State University at Chico, the author of numerous books, including Steal This Idea and Railroading Economics, here to talk about the state of the economy today in the United States and the world, and his new book, The Invisible Handcuffs of Capitalism, How Market Tyranny Stifles the Economy by Stunting Workers. Michael Perelman, welcome to Media Matters.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, Michael, before we get into your book, which I want to talk about, for the sake of my listeners, a little bit of your background, if we could. Where did you grow up? Where did you go to school? How many books have you written? What's your background?
I grew up in western Pennsylvania watching the Rust Belt evolve in the 1950s, excuse me, in the 1940s. Well, I didn't know much about it in the 1940s. And I ended up going to school at Michigan. I wasn't allowed out until I applied to 10 schools. So I applied to the top 10 football teams. And
were you a player or just a fan?
Huh?
Were you a player or a fan?
No, I just didn't want to waste time applying to colleges.
Uh-huh.
So I just picked the top 10 football teams. So I went to Michigan, had a wonderful time there. Eventually, went to graduate school at the University of California, Berkeley, between 65 and 70, which was a nice time to be there. And since then, I've been here at California State University, Chico.
Michael, just to interrupt you on that point, one of the things that's interesting to me is that, I came of age shortly after you, early 70s, when I finished high school and started going to college. And I remember then that there was a lot of discussion about the problems with capitalism as an economy. It was a widespread debate on college campuses about inequality, corruption, poverty, inhumanity, all sorts of issues. The sort of issues you write about were not uncommon to be debated on college campuses. And there was a lot of people at that time, 40 years ago, who said, we've got to think about a different type of economy if we're going to have a democratic society or a sane world. And what's interesting to me is today when I see people criticizing the current incarnation of capitalism in the United States, they often invoke that period as like the golden age. And when I grew up, that was the thing people wanted to get away from.
Yeah, I remember in high school, we used to count the days till we got out of town. It wasn't a great time. But I thought being in Berkeley in the 60s and in Michigan in the late 50s, it was a very exciting time. I mean, I had left by the time SDS started, but I knew some of the people who were instrumental in doing it. So, yeah, it was a period of great excitement. It wasn't a period of great optimism, but it was a period in which dreams still existed. And what's lacking today is any dream. I mean, the system is pretty much snuffed out virtually all hope. You saw it break through a little bit with the Occupy movement, and hopefully that can be sustained. But that's been some of the greatest damage.
And that's been a process, I imagine, that's taken place, you know, long term. In fact, in some ways, your book talks about how it's been part of the whole way the economy works.
Yes. I did an earlier book, The Confiscation of American Prosperity from Right-Wing Extremism and Economic Ideology to the Next Great Depression. It came out in 2007, in October, just when the stock market peaked. And what I did there was to talk about how the problems we are in were virtually inevitable. That is, we did everything we could to do it. In fact, if I were to retitle the book again, it just came out in paperback, and I was thinking I should have retitled it called A Handbook of Class Warfare, because that's what went on from the 60s onward, was very, very strong class warfare. But that was class warfare of the rich against the poor, of the strong against the weak.
Our guest today, Michael Perriman, talking to us on the phone. He's the author of the new book, The Invisible Handcuffs of Capitalism, just published, professor of economics at Cal State University in Chico. And let's talk a little bit about the book now, Michael Perriman. What are the invisible handcuffs of capitalism?
The invisible handcuffs of capitalism are really what's done to weaken the mass of people in the country. And I was looking at a particular kind of weakness in economic theory and in the way capitalism works. And the point of the book, the central point, was that capitalism pretends to be a very efficient way of mustering resources to create optimal output. And economics is a theory that shows why that's true. And the book was intended to describe why economics was way off course, which is probably the most complimentary thing I could say, and that the economy is set up not to maximize output or maximize efficiency, but it's set up to maintain profits. And central to maintaining profits was to maintain discipline of the working class. And that effort to maintain discipline is such that it restricts people's ability to develop their own potential. And it's that potential that possibly makes the economy and society work best.
I just have to wonder, Michael Perriman, how do your fellow economists and your faculty, or when you go to professional meetings, respond to your approach to their discipline or to your discipline?
Well, in this country, I don't think anybody notices me, which is why I'm allowed to do what I do. That is, if I were effective, I assume I'd be driven out of the university. I think I have much more recognition outside of the United States than I do within the United States.
Well, the subtitle of the book, Michael, is Market Tyranny. And I think that's sort of, could you elaborate on what market tyranny actually means, why you use that term?
Well, market tyranny, I was mostly describing market tyranny here in terms of what it does to society, in terms of that metaphor of the Procrustean bed. Procrustes was, of course, a mythological Greek innkeeper, and he had an iron bed.
You know, why don't you take a moment, since it's so important throughout the book, to talk about Procrustes and tell that myth, because I didn't know it until you mentioned it in the book.
Well, the idea of the myth was that people would unwittingly come to his inn, and if they were longer than the bed, they'd have part of their limbs cut off, and if they were too short, they'd be stretched to fit the bed. And the point is that everything has to fit the needs of capital, and everything that doesn't fit the bed will be punished.
And how does that manifest itself in the real world we live in today? What does that mean?
Well, I was thinking mostly in terms of what it means for the work processes. One of the critiques of economics that I make, a central one, is that they emphasize transactions, which are voluntary relationships, and therefore it removes any notion of conflict from the economic system, except the fact that conflict could be caused when government stupidly steps in and tries to tell business what to do. So in this way of looking at the economy, they don't pay any attention to matters of workers or working conditions. All you see is that workers go to the factory, they agree to accept a wage, then they leave a factory, and then all you see are inputs coming into the factory, like workers, and goods going out. What goes on there doesn't appear. And what that does is it snuffs out any vision, any insight into what could be going on in the workplace, where people could be learning, could be developing. Marx has a beautiful, beautiful passage in around page 700 of the Grundrisse, where he says that, in effect, capital has done this magnificent job of reducing the labor content of all of its products. And if labor is very small, then you could have a different emphasis. That is, you can't imagine a restaurant paying too much attention to whether their customers are taking too much salt. It's a trivial cost. And that what they could be doing instead would be allowing the workers at the workplace to be learning to use the workplace almost as a university as well as a place of production. And the result of that would be an intensification of output. You see a little bit of that with Google, hardly a socialist organization, where they give the workers a few days off during the year and they just work on whatever they think will work out. And obviously, a lot of what people will be doing will be of no use at all to anybody. But those few that spark something will be of tremendous value to the company and perhaps even to society. So we emphasize discipline, and you see that in the educational process, where you and I, our job is comparable to that of a meat inspector. Remember, in meat, they used to have those blue stamps from the USDA. And your job is to put class of 2013, U of A, grade B minus or whatever, where what the university should be is a place where people can be exposed to all sorts of new ideas, even ideas that don't get heard at all virtually in the university today, and we have a better society for it. Instead, what we're getting is a more intensification of education based on supposed accountability, but what they really mean instead of accountability is countability, something that they can put a measure on, even though the measure has nothing to do with anything real.
Our guest today, who you just been listening to, Michael Perron, author of the new book, The Invisible Handcuffs of Capitalism. This is a live version of Media Matters. Our phone lines are open at 217-333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. You mentioned an interesting point right there, Michael, about Google. And I've seen sometimes this discussion about firms in Japan, where instead of having the traditional hierarchical relations inside the factory or inside the corporation, where the workers basically fulfill the function you were talking about in the Procrustean bed, they are apparently given more leeway, more control, more autonomy, more freedom, more creativity. And the argument goes that this actually works to the benefit of the firm, ultimately, that makes them more productive and makes more profits for the firm. I don't know if that's true or not. That's what I've read. If it is true, or even remotely closer to, why aren't smart firms doing that all over the world? Why aren't they doing that in China?
Part of the reason, I think, is that people who run the firm, one of the important considerations isn't just straight profit, but it's a feeling of power. And you exercise power by making somebody else powerless. And I think there's a great resistance to that. Now, there was one case that a Harvard professor went up and studied papermaking factories. And she found one example of a papermaking factory that opened up their whole information processing system. All the data, everything that was going on in the factory that they had on their computers was available to anybody in the company, workers included. workers then started making changes in the way they were producing the paper, and the changes turned out to be very, very efficient. And the response to that innovation was to shut down the whole system, to close it off from workers. And what the workers were saying was, here are these high-priced executives, and they don't know anything compared to what we do or what we could do. And in effect, they were demeaning the bosses because the bosses were the people who were supposed to have all the information, all the wisdom, all the insight, and thereby deserve their outsized salaries and bonuses.
So what happens in Japan? These bosses just have smaller egos?
I think I've read totally conflicting stories about Japan. I've read stories in which Japanese factories sound more totalitarian than those in America. And I've read the stories where workers are supposed to have much more access to management, and their ideas would listen to very carefully. So I don't know which to believe.
And then what happens at Google? Are the hacky sack CEO of Google just sort of a cool dude?
Well, we really don't know what these people are coming up with on their free Fridays. I suspect that it could be something very, very valuable. Yeah. And it would be valuable, and it would be valuable to the company in two ways. One, people would feel better about what they're doing and put more into their work. And two, I'm sure they're coming up with some very, very interesting ideas that are going to be profitable to Google.
But I guess that begs the question, how come the people who at Google are smart enough to see that, but the people who ran the shoe factory or that other factory you were talking about weren't?
I think the difference is I think the people in Google are probably more confident, more self-confident, and they probably don't need as much deference from the workers, in the sense that the people who run Google are already cult heroes and nobody would question their right and authority. Where if you have a manager of a relatively mundane paper mill, they might not have the same self-confidence.
Well, maybe here's another idea to throw at you, Michael Perriman. What if it's that, you know, we're moving to this new high technology digital economy where there's much less traditional assembly line factory work, and it's more knowledge work, and this is going to create a new capitalism that will lend itself to much more cooperative and humane ways of organizing economic activity within firms. Is that possible?
The tooth fairy is also possible.
Were you just describing elements of that for Google? I mean,
but what I said is that there are unusual elements that have to do with the type of leadership. That is, Google, Steve Jobs, we are all elevated to almost a cult status.
You mean he's Apple, I think.
Pardon?
Steve Jobs?
Yes.
Apple, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Steve Jobs was almost considered a cult figure, and the three main people at Google were similarly seen as cult figures. That I think if you had your senator walk into a room and have one of the three principals of Google walk into the room, I think people pay more attention to the Google people. Now, if you had the kind of world that you were talking about, you couldn't have all of them being elevated into cult status. They want to show that status. And one of the ways you show your status is by taking it out on your underlings. Even if it's not done maliciously, it's just done to show I'm the boss, which is destructive. I don't know about you, but we've had a series of deans, or present dean is terrific. We've had a series of deans that wanted to assert authority, and it turned out that what they did was very, very disruptive to the whole department.
Now, Michael Perriman, can unions, trade unions representing workers, can they effectively stop demeaning labor practices, stop workplace grueling conditions, and sort of have the power to turn them into something closer to page 700 in the Grandrisse?
Yes, yes, of course, yes. And then we put in a big but with capital B, and that is, to what extent do the union leaders take on the mask of a boss rather than a representative of the worker?
Okay, and what is the answer to that?
I think you know the answer to that.
Well, our listeners might not, so why don't you tell
them? Oh, I think your listeners do know the answer to it.
Assume one or two of them don't.
For the single person out there who doesn't know, many of the union leaders do act as bosses rather than acting as a vehicle for the workers to be able to voice their own needs and opinions.
All right. Our guest today, Michael Perriman, author of The Invisible Handcuffs of Capitalism, just published by Monthly Review Press. Michael, one of the figures who plays a large role in economics and plays a big role in your book is Adam Smith. And can you just give a little bit of background on why he's important and what role he plays in your book?
I think Adam Smith is important and because he was the person who made the transition from looking at labor and the labor process to looking at transactions. And that gave economics a way of avoiding any idea of work, workers, or working conditions. It gave the way economics could see the economy as a totally harmonious system in which everything was voluntary, there is no authority. And so Smith was he's a very strange person. I mean, I've written about Smith in several places, and he's totally contradictory, totally dishonest, and yet sometimes he will say very nice things, and then you look at the context. For instance, he has a nice place where he is bemoaning the division of labor and what it does to people, even though he's pushing in the first part of his book the division of labor. Then it turns out you look at what he's talking about, and he's saying, if you have a strong division of labor, what it does to workers is it makes them imperfect soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have a very favorable opinion of him, which puts me in a big minority because even Marxists tend to look favorably on Adam Smith.
Now I understand why, free market economists like Adam Smith, he's held up for the reasons you just pointed out as the champion of markets and sort of the first economist who really grasped the genius of markets.
No.
But why would someone who's hostile to markets, say a Marxist economist, what would the appeal of Adam Smith be to them?
Because there were things in Adam Smith that he picked up that were actually good analysis of the market. That is, you may not be a good coach, but you may be very good at working with one individual player. So he had some insights that were fairly good. And he wasn't openly hostile to workers, and he was one of the best writers ever to write about economics.
He was also, he came along exactly as the Industrial Revolution was beginning, really the modern Industrial Revolution. His timing was he was right there.
Yes, yes. And what's interesting about that is the Industrial Revolution, the heart of the Industrial Revolution was in the same village that he lived in.
Wow.
In walking distance. And the owners of the factory were friends of his. And you know what? He never talked about the factory, because a factory is a place where you need more discipline. He talks about small workshops. And he doesn't even talk about coal except as a consumer product that you would use to heat your house or cook your food. Never mentions the Industrial Revolution. So what you said was true. He is writing right in the heart of the Industrial Revolution. During the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, what we normally call the Industrial Revolution, he never once talked about it.
Our guest, Michael Perriman, author of the new book, The Invisible Handcuffs of Capitalism. We're coming to you live today in WILL AM 580. The phone lines are open at 217-333-9455. Toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Michael Perriman, one of the really interesting discussions in the book is with the whole notion of the gross domestic product, the GDP, a term we hear all the time, as sort of the symbol of the quantity of the output of the economy for usually for a year's period. And the measure of the strength of the economy in many respects. What's your take on the GDP? Why is it in the book, and what's your analysis?
Well, the GDP, again, going back to the idea of we measure everything in terms of transactions. And the GDP is just a summing up of all the transactions going on in the economy. And that's it. But there's a lot more going on in the way we produce our lives than in simple transactions. It hides a great deal.
So what would the Perelman GDP include?
Well, the Perelman GDP would include housework. And in fact, Kuznets, who was the first person, Simon Kuznets, my thesis advisor's brother, was the first person to do it. And he complained, and he said, as he did the GDP, to tell the military during World War II how much resources they could divert from the civilian economy. And at the time, it was said that he was worth two divisions in the army. I don't know how many thousand people, because of what he did, making victory possible. But after the war, he wrote, he says there's no excuse for not counting household labor, which is every bit as important as work going on in factories. At the same time, the GDP, a few people have played with the idea, should include not just what we're producing, but what we're destroying. So if you have a GDP, and part of that GDP, it depends upon some very destructive activity that will make the country uninhabitable or resources not available anymore, that should be counted.
So specifically there, what comes out in your example is environmental damage.
Environmental damage would be something else. So it's a very, very imperfect kind of measure, but it gives us a type of a sense of accountability. It also gives us a sense that that we economists are scientific because we're dealing with hard facts and numbers, even if the facts and numbers are not reflective of what's going on.
So housework, if it's done by a private company, so you hire someone to clean your house, that goes in the GDP.
That's GDP, yes.
If you clean your own house, it doesn't.
Yes.
And the reason is the GDP is to sort of measure business transactions, not to measure actual value creation in the economy.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, that's a good lesson, Professor Perelman. Thank you for that. Well, the other issue that I thought was really interesting in the book, and this is something that it gets, I think, into a difficult area, but it still is very important, is this whole question of happiness studies and the relationship of, you know, how happy are people in a so-called wealthy society, and how closely linked is GDP growth to whether people are leading fulfilling lives?
It's not linked at all. I think the happiness studies suggest people in Cuba, oh, God forbid, are as happy as people in the United States. And another comparison I use in the book is Nigeria and Germany. And I don't know what makes happiness. Now, I was recently in Bogota, and the Colombians are supposed to be extraordinarily happy. And it was curious to me, because you couldn't go anywhere without people opening up your backpack and seeing what's in it to make sure it's not a bomb. And yet the people really did look happy. And yet there was a great deal of inequality and poverty in Colombia. So I think what's important in making happiness is to have strong family bonds, strong ties of friendship and community, which is even more than having a larger flat-screen television set.
Where do Americans stand in these sort of happiness scales?
Very modestly. Very modestly. Not particularly happy at all.
We're not number one?
No.
Okay.
We're number one in so many things.
Never in the top 100?
Yeah.
Has it changed? I'm just curious, you know, from, say, the 1960s or 70s, because you talked at the beginning of the show about, you know, the sort of the depression might not be the right word for mood, but the sort of sense of hopelessness that people have about the world in America. And which I think would be part of not being especially happy.
Yeah.
And has that changed in America? Were we once a happier people?
The 50s were a period when the happiness... Now remember, these happiness studies are probably no more precise than the GDP.
Yeah,
that
of
is,
course.
It's very difficult to actually measure happiness going around and saying to people, how happy are you? But it does show that the 50s were a period of relative happiness, and I think the reason for that was that there was a certain degree of stability. And now you have a world in which very, very important people are saying workers should get used to the idea of not having a job. That is, you're employed here, and then you go there, and then you go there, and don't get tied down to a job. That creates a great deal of instability. It makes it hard to keep up family ties, friendships, and at the same time, jobs themselves are becoming increasingly insecure, pensions disappearing. So I think the turmoil that we're going through has taken a real hit on happiness, but I haven't seen any recent studies that would support it. But I'd be willing to bet, not like Mitt Romney, $10,000, but $10, that any legitimate measure of happiness would show a significant decline, especially since this so-called recession looks like a depression to me.
What about commercialism and advertising, the incessant sales pitch? Is there a connection between that and sort of the bonds of community and human happiness? And this isn't a rhetorical question. It's a very serious question.
No. It's funny. I've written about that in a different book called Manufacturing Discontent.
And that's why I'm asking you.
And I'm making the case that I make a case there that advertising should be illegal. And the reason it should be illegal is that it's the purpose of business. It's the purpose of the economy to make people happy. What advertising does is it makes you discontent. That is, you have the last version of an iPhone. You know, this new one's so much better. So in effect, what they're doing is they're increasing this presumable utility for getting a new product, but they're also diminishing the utility or the happiness that has to do with what you have. So a large part of what advertising does is to make you unhappy with your present condition and make you aspire to something that you don't have. It may be something that you may never even get the chance to have. So advertising is very, very destructive in that respect.
Has there been research done on levels of advertising in society and happiness correlating the two, if not establishing?
There may have.
Yeah.
There should be, but I haven't seen them.
Okay.
Which doesn't mean that they don't exist.
That's right, and I haven't seen them either, but my eyes feel. Listeners, if you know of them, please send them to me, and I'll pass them to Professor Perlman. Our guest, Michael Perlman, author of the new book, The Invisible Handcuffs of Capitalism, How Market Tyranny Stifles the Economy by Stunning Workers. We're talking about it live today on WILL AM 580. Just a note before we go back to our guest, I'm going to be gone for the next 2 weeks. We've pre-recorded a couple of shows. I think you really enjoy them. Next week is going to be a pledge drive show here on WILL. John Nichols will be the guest, and John and I just recently recorded a program talking about the Wisconsin recall and various political issues in the United States. And Kimberly Cronick from WILL will be doing some pledge wrapping between the segments. I do hope next week you'll listen and that you will make a pledge, because, as you know, the station definitely needs your support. So please consider doing that 1 week from today. I will be back on July 8th going full bore for the summer with a whole lineup of great guests, I think, that you will enjoy. But let's go back to our guest today, Michael Perlman, and talk to him about his book. And Michael, when I was reading your book, the whole question of corporations is sort of interesting, and the relationship of corporations to capitalism. You could probably make an argument that if corporations had a healthy function, they might have passed that moment in history at this point. When you look at all these guys making executive salaries that are just off the charts, and all the sort of looks like they're just sort of eating their own in these units now.
Yes, yeah, that was more what I was talking about in the Confiscation of American Prosperity book, in the fact that the whole structure of the corporate system is really dysfunctional, and when they try to reform it, they make it worse. So if you went back to the 70s, people were complaining that corporations were not accountable enough. That is, corporations weren't accountable enough. And this started with my own pension plan, CalPERS, that was saying, we want to make sure that our investments are done well. And so we want to have measurements that we can use. This gets back to this idea of accountability,
mm-hmm.
that we can use in order to tell whether you're doing a good job. So what could they use to tell whether you're doing a good job? You use stock prices.
Mm-hmm.
And your salaries then will be based on stock prices. So then you have corporations spending, literally in the case of Exxon, billions of dollars just to buy back the stock, which raises the stock price, which then raises the bonuses,
mm-hmm.
which then require that the corporation charge you more money. First of all, so they can pay for the bonuses, and second of all, so that they can keep the stock going up in value. Totally dysfunctional.
Let's go to our phone lines now to a caller who's been waiting patiently. Line 4, Spring Bay, you're on the air with Michael Perlman.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I've never had a course in economics. I remember my social studies textbook from my eighth grade year in 1962 had a chart. I think it was like a downward spiral talking about the Great Depression. And my question is this. What is your opinion of, are we in a deflationary period or an inflationary period? If deflationary, do you think that these austerity budgets will worsen the situation, or will they eventually improve it? So I guess that's my specific question. I'll get off and listen off the air. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Michael Perlman?
As you've heard from any sane economist, the austerity budget will be a total disaster for the economy. That is, it'll require that more people lose their jobs, more businesses go out of business. It'll intensify all the bad things. But what it will do will be to solidify the infrastructure, the social infrastructure of power. And it will increasingly disempower labor. It will increasingly empower corporate sectors. And just as you saw with the financial crash, rather than harming the big corporations, they just, especially in finance, they just got bigger. As far as the inflation, deflation, that's a very interesting question. I think that there's a twofold answer, and each of them are contradictory to the other. And that is, in terms of resources, it's going to become increasingly difficult for a large population that we have that's growing and with a standard of living that's growing to continue to be able to supply the resources that people are using. I'm talking about raw materials, food, without seeing inflation. At the same time, manufacturing is such that for reasons that would take a little bit too long to explain here, manufacturing has a deflationary bias. So what we're going to see in the future, I would predict, would be increasing inflation in food and raw materials and increasing deflation in terms of manufactured products.
Michael Perlman, I had Paul Krugman on the program last week, and he has a new book out called Stop This Depression Now. And Krugman's argument is the Keynesian argument, or a Keynesian argument, not necessarily the Keynesian argument, that we actually have the knowledge, resources, policies in place that this depression could be ended and we could have full employment and growth inside the current capitalist economy without making any reforms in the way the economy works, just by monetary and especially fiscal policy. And that all that really prevents it is just the political power of the wealthy just are opposed to something that would sort of threaten their control over everything. Do you agree with that?
Yes. Yes.
That's interesting. You think that we actually, even capitalism now, even with all its, you know, inefficiencies and corporations and corruption, the Obama administration could actually just put in policies that would actually get us to 4% unemployment and have the economy cooking?
Well, that is one of the policies that could be done would be to wipe out a lot of debt. And it's unlikely that that would be able to be done. I mean, doubling the minimum wage is far more likely than to be able to wipe out the debt. And you see people now who are concerned with what is going to happen to the next generation of workers who come out of the go into the workforce with $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 worth of debt to begin with. First of all, that means they're not going to be able to concentrate as much on their work. It means that they're not going to be able to buy things, and it's a serious problem. The other thing that we would need to do would be to reduce the emphasis of financialization so that at the time of the crash, financial profits, that is from a finance, investment, real estate, the so-called FIRE sector, represented 40% of all profits. That's measured. But there were other profits that are really financial that are not counted in financial profits. So financial profits are much, much higher.
What sort of profits are hidden or not included in the FIRE sector?
You go buy a piece of electronics, and they'll ask you for do you want a warranty on it? And the warranty is, in fact, an insurance policy. And often when you get something at a big box retailer in electronics, there is no profit from the sale. The profit comes from the insurance policy.
So I'm sorry, go ahead, Professor.
Oh, so what they're doing is they're saying to you, Bob, we're not going to make anything on this computer, on this television, but you'll buy this warranty, and that will be our profit.
Right now, Professor Perlman, it looks like the economy for this decade we're in now will probably have a lower growth rate based on where we're going now than the past decade did from 2000 to 2009, which was the lowest decade for growth since the 1930s. And nothing on the horizon, at least, looks like that's going to change. Now, it could possibly change. No one can predict the future. But at least for what we can see, the visible future, it doesn't look very good. And as you just pointed out, you put lock into place a generation of young workers now, not only with debt, but without job prospects for many of them, that this sort of has a snowball effect down the road that makes the problem that much worse. What is your sense of the course of American capitalism as an economist and as one who studied historically going forward the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years?
Well, what we've seen is a long-term trajectory in which the rate of growth has been going down each decade. Now, you mentioned the 30s, and one of the things that happened during the 30s was that a lot of effort increased productivity in the 30s. That is, companies who were really worried about things suddenly got serious about efficiency, and a lot of the post-war boom came from not just all the things we normally hear about, but productivity improvements that came in during the Depression. Now, the difference is that unlike the Depression, you will see, increases in efficiency in manufacturing, but manufacturing is a very small part of the economy. Where is the intensification of profit-making going on? It's going on in finance. So, like Krugman, I think you could do it, except the remedy that I see is much more in-depth than what he talks about, and it requires things that would require very, very strong and progressive leadership. We don't have it. But as long as the economy continues to emphasize finance rather than production, I don't see where we're going.
Let's go back to our phone lines now. Our guest, of course, Professor Michael Perlman. And let's go to line one, Champaign County. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. I wanted to go back to Adam Smith. I'm still kind of dumbfounded by the idea that he was in the midst of the Industrial Revolution and didn't really write about it. And I always, I haven't read him directly. I do rely on Noam Chomsky's reading of him, and it's pretty astonishing some of the things that he points out. That in one tract, he points out that Adam Smith actually has cautionary notes about the combines, which in the 17th century. That would be sort of the equivalent of corporate power. So he's a bit of a critic of corporate power, and you say he's all over the place, so maybe at different phases or something. The other thing is that Chomsky asserts, and has footnotes to point it out, that the famous phrase, the invisible hand, which is supposed to be about the market, he says that in The Wealth of Nations, the only time that he uses that phrase is, maybe he uses a concept somewhere else, but the only place he uses that phrase, he's actually cautioning British manufacturers, merchants, and investors to not turn abroad, and that it would be a bad thing for England. And so it's he calls it a critique of neoliberalism. And that's pretty bizarre, considering how he's sort of just, Smith is used as sort of holy scripture. So I don't know how you'll react to that, but I wanted to get that in there. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Michael Perlman?
I react very positively. Yes, Adam Smith did say those things. Part of the reason he was against big corporations was that the state promoted the South Sea Company, which created a terrible depression. It was a swindle, it was a fraud, and it did terrible damage. Smith is against any kind of government support, and he sees the large corporations as being dependent on government support. He wants independence. So in a sense, it's a Ron Paul type of analysis. And yes, he does want to emphasize the domestic market, because the domestic market would be more likely to be served by small producers. He's in favor of the small producers. He's opposed to the large entrenched corporations. So, yes, he was fearful about getting too involved in imperial policies, which was a major debate going on in England at the time.
Our guest, Michael Perlman, author of The Invisible Handcuffs of Capitalism, and I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. Let's go back to the phone lines to another caller. Line 2, Champaign County, you're on the air.
Thank you. Continuing the small issue about being small as far as promoting the economy, small is beautiful was in my day. Gar Perovitz was a guest on this program a few weeks ago, also talking about small as a basis for economy. What's your assessment? Is that really a solution?
Again, I think it's, look, in everything in economics, the proper answer is yes and no. So I'll be a proper economist and I'll say yes and no. You wouldn't want to have local post offices, which create tremendous complexity of how do you put all the post offices together. We had terrible inefficiency in the railroads when different railroads used different gauges, and you had to unload your freight to get on a different track of a different gauge. On the other hand, there are some things in which small is appropriate. So I think the word there, the operative word would be appropriative. That is, the mass of what Google has makes it efficient, makes it very, very convenient. But imagine if you had Google divided up into 10,000 different categories, and you wouldn't know where to. You'd need a Google of Googles to know which Google to go to. So I think we're on the wrong track if we think about small versus large in absolutes, and I think you'd have to look case by case as what is the appropriate scale.
Well, let me interrupt if I can, Michael Perlman, and then follow up on the Alperovitz line of argument. And I think the economists Rick Wolf and Juliet Shore have also been working in this area, which is the idea that what is needed now is to build up cooperatives, worker-run businesses and enterprises at the local level where appropriate. And going into distressed communities like Cleveland, Ohio, which Alperovitz writes about a lot, but there are a lot of them in this country. And rather than just having workers and businesses lie empty, put them to use in sort of cooperatives and build a whole alternative economy as much as possible now without waiting for politicians. What's your take on that?
Very positive about it. That's what I'm thinking about the word appropriate. Mm-hmm. That's very appropriate. You can take
take advantage of unused skills. You can give people opportunities where they can develop their organizational and community powers. That's all very wonderful. But there are things for which that would be difficult to set up.
Yeah. Well, you know, let's, if we can switch gear, because, Michael, we don't have a lot of time left, and there's a lot of ground I still want to cover, but I would be remiss today, in view of the Greek election, not to ask you about, you know, what's happening in Europe and, you know, how that relates to American capitalism. I mean, what's at stake in Europe right now, in your view?
I would think that, I think a great deal is in stake, because we're not, there is no American capitalism, there is no Greek capitalism, there's just capitalism. And the big fear here is that because all the banks are interlinked, if you pull out one part of the structure, the entire structure can come down. And so they're asking Greeks and Irish people and Italians to give up and work harder and pay more taxes and get less benefits in order to shore up the banking system, which is the problem. And yet, even the modest attempt to regulate banking with Dodd-Frank is being weakened and weakened and weakened. So we may be able to shore up the Greek system today, but there's going to be another crisis soon after, and I don't see us doing anything about it. Now, here we get into the other problem about large versus small, and one of the reasons Adam Smith is against the large corporations is the reason we should be against it. There's a trade-off between efficiency and the power that the corporations can exercise. And as long as the financial system is as big and as strong as it is, it's going to be very difficult. And the rest of us are merely the tail on that big dog.
Michael Perelman, if you were called up and commissioned to moderate a debate between President Obama and Republican candidate Mitt Romney, or presumptive candidate Mitt Romney for president, on the economy, and you were said you could have one question to ask each of them, what would that question be?
Why are you so stupid?
Okay, what's your second question?
Are you willing to do anything real that will make things better, or are you just an absolute tool of the capitalist class?
Do you? Are there any, in your view, what are the differences, if there are any, between an Obama economic policy or program and a Romney one, from what you can see based on?
I'm sure there are differences. I'm sure there are differences. I think what Obama does will be slicker than Romney's, but I don't think the difference will be all that much. It will come more on the red meat issues that aren't going to affect the economy as much. So you could really fire up the troops by some red meat issue. There isn't a big Islamic electorate to worry about, so you can take out, we'll oppose Sharia law, something like that. But I don't see serious differences between them.
Michael Perelman, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means we're running short on time. If people want to find out more about your work, in addition to getting a copy of your new book, The Invisible Handcuffs of Capitalism, is there a website they could go to?
Well, I have a website you can find under Unsettling Economics.
Unsettling Economics.
Yes.
And I want to thank you so much, Michael Perelman, for taking time out of your Sunday to join us here at Media Matters. It's been a pleasure having you in the program.
It's been a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
And I want to thank Kyle Kroha, as always, for working the board, Christina Williams for being my phenomenal producer, and all of you for taking time out of your summer afternoon to listen to this program. Remember, the next 2 weeks will be recorded, then we're back live with you. Next week, pledge drive, get that credit card and checkbook out. We need your support. Thank you very much. I'm Bob McChesney. Have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events. Lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
The weather forecast calls for mostly cloudy skies today and tonight. There's a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms today, the high 88. Tonight's low 68. It'll be sunny and windy on Monday with the high around 92 and mostly clear Monday night, the low 72. This is Illinois Public Media.